the presentation over to our next presenter, Eric Lawrence. Eric?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Eric Lawrence. I'm a security program manager for the Internet Explorer team. I've never done one of these live meeting things before, so we can anticipate some glitches probably, but let's get started. So in Internet Explorer 7, I was the program manager for networking and a couple of trust features, particularly the SSL user experience in IE7. And I developed a bunch of unsupported tools for Internet Explorer. Tamper IE is one of them. It's a security tool. IE Toys is some end user plugins, and Fiddler, which is a network debugger for Windows. And then in Internet Explorer 8, I took on the security job, and it's been a very interesting one. And this deck is really kind of a summation of the work that we've done throughout Internet Explorer 8 for security. There's actually some callbacks to things that we did in IE7 that are still relevant. But my overall goal is to kind of give you a picture of what we did, why we did it, and kind of where we think the attacks are going in the future. Certainly, if you have questions, please do let me know. The deck is pretty long, and I've got a couple of demos. But as I understand it, I've got an hour and a half, which is probably the longest I've talked nonstop, so any questions are fine. So the first question is, you know, are we done yet? You know, Internet Explorer 8 came out. We did a ton of security work in IE7. We did a bunch more of security work in IE8. And, you know, are we ready to just call it, you know, we've done security? And, you know, every time I ship a product, my mom kind of asks me, like, you know, okay, you're done. You're on version 8. Like, you know, that's the last one, right? The answer is no. Of course it's not. And, you know, basically the problem is that browser security is a really elusive thing. And so, you know, a lot of people, you know, like my mom or normal people who don't work in the software field kind of want to know why, right? How is it that you can keep working on this problem and still have more to do? And there's a bunch of different answers, but one of the key answers, I think, that isn't really well understood by a lot of people is that browser security is a very intricate thing. There's a ton of moving parts in browser security, and because of what's been happening, it's getting more complex and not less. And that's because one of the primary goals of the W3C and sort of the web platform in general is to build a much, much more powerful platform on top of the web. You know, back in the mid-90s, it was really about links, and, you know, occasionally you'd have a little tiny JavaScript that would do something or another, but you weren't building complicated applications. And that's changed. Really, the web is becoming an application platform, and through things like HTML5 and other specs and standards, we're getting to a much, much larger attack surface. And so as we build the browser, this is something that we have to keep in mind, because if we don't, we're really going to fail, and you know, we're going to ship a version. You know, one of the things that we love to say every time we ship a version of IE is, this is the most secure browser we've ever shipped. And, you know, I got a mail the other day, and it's like, you know, would you ever ship a less secure browser? And I said, well, you know, not with me in charge of security. But the reality is, if you weren't careful, you really could. Because as we add these capabilities to the browser platform, we could potentially be increasing attack surface. And unless we're very careful not to do so, that's a risk. And so that's a kind of a recurring theme that you're going to see through the deck. The security architecture of the web platform as it exists today is mostly an afterthought. So back in the mid-90s, you know, when you were building these web-based applications, the only things that the attacker really cared about were getting remote code execution on your box. You visit their website, they own your computer. And so all of the attacks were really tightly targeted. How can we get the user to run code on their machine so we can take over their machine and we can do bad things with it? But unfortunately, the reality is today, some of that is becoming much less appealing. If all of my valuable data, my photos, my bank information, my contact information, is all in the cloud, I don't need to attack the computer. I can attack websites. Now, obviously, direct attacks on websites are one vector. You don't even need a browser for that. You know, if there's a SQL injection hole in a website, you just go attack the website directly. But a lot of the very interesting attacks today are about attacking websites using the user's browser, the victim browser, to actually execute those attacks against websites they trust to steal data or otherwise cause badness to happen. And so because of that, the security architecture of the web is now very important. Things like same origin policy, which are incredibly subtle and complex, such that most web developers don't even really understand what same origin policy is all about, make it very difficult to build secure web applications. And the browsers are now recognizing this and starting to build in some new things that support the security model of the web as it exists today. The problem, of course, is we can't just throw out what we had, because if so, essentially you'd have to kind of reboot, go write Web 2.0 for real, where none of the old sites work anymore, and you've got kind of a new web platform. And that's never likely to take off. And so we have to innovate in the security space as we maintain compatibility. Now, I'm really lazy as a program manager. I want to be done. And so, you know, the first thing I see whenever I take on any problem is, You know, this thing has been going on a long time. Maybe there's a shortcut that nobody thought about. And if you look at the web security problem, you know, there's some obvious things that come to mind. One of them is we actually know of a way to block almost 100% of the exploits of the web browsing platform system just by removing one component. That component, unfortunately, is useful for other things, right? If you pull the network cable, there's really no security problem anymore because the user is going to be looking at local content, fully trusted content. The problem with the web from a security point of view very often is its intrinsic value of being able to link sites from all over the world. You know, when I'm driving down to my bank in the morning to make a deposit, I never accidentally end up in Romania. But with a web browser, you could. You could think you're going to your bank, but you're really going to a Romanian phishing site. And so this is a very significant difference from the web in the real world, where people say, well, why can't you just make the web as secure as the real world? And the answer is, well, a lot of the value of the web is the fact that it's very different from the real world. And so we, as security engineers, have to figure out ways of keeping the value of the web without putting users at risk from these types of non-real world attacks. Now, looking at this problem further, there's another component to the system that we could actually remove that would reduce almost all of the security problems that we have in the browser today. And that component of the system, of course, is the user themselves. And this is actually kind of a growing threat as the browsers have become harder. Right? Browser, you know, users will navigate everywhere, right? And so we kind of take it as an assumption that the user can be lured to go to almost any site. And so what we've done over the years is we've hardened the browser such that you can go to pretty much any untrusted site in the world, and nothing is automatically bad going to happen to you. The problem is the user is kind of an escape hatch from the whole security system because for a variety of reasons, the user remains in control of their browsing experience, and the user can often be fooled into making bad choices. And social engineering attacks against the user are on the rise and are expected to continue to rise because the browsing platforms themselves are becoming harder and harder targets. And so unless we do more to sort of shield this vulnerable component in the system, we're going to have a security problem indefinitely into the future. You know, I went to an RSA security conference about a year and a half ago, and he said, you know, how do we solve social engineering problems without shooting all of the users? And the answer is, well, you know, you don't have to shoot the user, because often the problem is not that the user, you know, the user themselves is inherently a problem. The problem is the user makes bad trust decisions. And in some environments, particularly corporate IT environments, what you can do is take the security choice out of the hands of the user. And we'll talk about that shortly. So, you know, re-architect everything, get rid of the users, unplug the network, security is easy. None of that's going to work. We're not going to have the web browser. We're not going to have the success that we have today in the web platform if we do those things. So we have to work within those constraints. Sometimes we can poke at them and say, well, maybe it's a little more subtle, right? Maybe there is a way that we can at least inform the user where in the world they are and things like that. But for the most part, these are the absolutes that we have to work with. So security is easy. Trade-offs are hard. Figuring out what trade-offs to make in the platform between capabilities and security, between compatibility and security, between performance and security, it's those trade-offs that are hard and where we spend a significant part of our time. So kind of looking back, Internet Explorer 7 significantly reduced the attack surface against the browser and the local machine. We did features like protected mode. We did features like ActiveX opt-in. We did a ton of work to really make it such that the drive-bys were not the risk that they once were, where you visit a website and something automatically happens and now you've got malicious code running on your computer. So that was a major investment in IE7. The problem is, of course, attackers aren't static. Social engineering and exploitive add-on vulnerabilities continues to grow. And we'll talk very briefly, very shortly about that. But the other interesting thing that we started to see with IE8 is vulnerabilities in web applications, things like cross-site request forgery, cross-site scripting, clickjacking, HTTP response splitting. All of these things are on the rise because, as I mentioned before, so much of the valuable data that the user has is now on the website. So unless we can help websites build themselves in ways that are more secure or automatically secure websites without impairing the compatibility, you know, we're never going to be able to keep up because, you know, the user's browser will be this perfect, reliable, perfectly secure, really fast platform for exploiting the websites that they care about. And we don't want that either. And then the last problem, you know, of course, is that the next generation of attackers are coming out of grade school. And, you know, originally this was kind of a joke, but the reality is we had a security guy come here for one of our security conferences. I think it was about a year or two ago. And he couldn't go out to any of the parties because he was underage. And, you know, we couldn't even take him up to Vancouver because he wasn't even 19 yet. And so, you know, there's this constantly growing field of people that are really interested in poking in the browsing platform because let's face it, you can make a pretty big name for yourself if you find a vulnerability in a popular website or in a popular browser. And, of course, you know, the key distinction behind all of this is that it turns out that crime really does pay after all. And so I saw a press report about a week ago. You know, Microsoft has put up $250,000 bounty for some of the guys behind one of the latest malware threats. And, you know, the press was noting that, well, these guys are churning out about $250,000 a month from running this botnet. And so this might not be enough reward to get any of these guys to turn against their compatriots. And so because crime pays, there's an economic incentive for bad guys to actually go out and actively try and do new things to exploit the browser. Unlike things like standards compatibility or performance, where it's really kind of the browser against the machine, we're always trying to do better, you know, in this case, the attackers are not static. We can't, you know, ship a browser, call it secure, and the bad guys just go away and find something else to do with their lives. They're going to go out and try and poke holes in our defenses. And it's one of the things that's great for keeping my job interesting, because I've always got to be, you know, looking at what the attackers are doing and working with Microsoft security teams to try and figure out where they're going next. Yes, or we can run hacking competitions before we release, although that can actually backfire. I imagine you're referring to CanSec West, which was a security conference in Vancouver earlier this month. And one of the things there actually was, you know, one of the bad guys there, well, he's not really a bad guy, but one of the attackers there had actually attacked Safari using a vulnerability he found a year before. And he just kept it to himself so he could win the competition next year. And so competitions as a mechanism for finding security vulnerabilities are kind of fraught with their own set of peril, because there's no guarantee that you're actually going to get all the exploits, because people might just, you know, queue them up. And so certainly doing contests is really interesting and neat, and we might talk a bit more about that later. But you really have to have a very comprehensive process. And this is actually kind of, you know, a summary of what we did. Our security vision is that Internet Explorer 8 is the most secure browser by default. Now, you know, it's kind of a good high-level mission, get everybody rally around, but what does it actually mean? Well, when we look at it in kind of three different ways. First is that security feature improvements. These are the things, you know, the equivalent of the locks on your doors or the alarm system in your house. Things that don't exist except for the fact that they provide security. There's a need for this. We did a ton of investments here in the IE7 timeframe. We did some in the XPSP2 timeframe. We did a few more in the IE8 timeframe. But this is kind of fading away, because when you do security feature improvements, the only benefit is to security. Nothing else really wins. And what we really need to do is we need to build secure features. And this is where we spent probably half of our time in Internet Explorer 8, is building new features out securely, such that as we're expanding the scope of our platform, as we're increasing its power, we're not increasing its attack surface. And that's really key. And in fact, some of the work that we did in IE8 actually will effectively reduce the attack surface of the browser, even though we've added new features. And we'll talk about why that is in a couple of slides. And then lastly is about providing security and compatibility. And this is a lesson that we didn't do very well in Internet Explorer 7, and it's one of the reasons that uptake was low, was we didn't do enough to ensure compatibility of the product before we released it. You know, we thought we did enough, but the reality is the web is huge. The Internet Explorer team comparatively is tiny. And so it's really key to us that we actually ensure that we build a browser that's compatible enough with the web today that it doesn't impair adoption. Every time we consider adding a security feature, we have to look at, will this prevent people from uptake of the browser? If it does, then we have to make a very, very hard trade-off, because any security feature that causes a corporation or a large number of users not to update the browser is a security feature that puts all the other security work at risk. We talked to a major web platform company about a year ago, and we said, what can we do for security to make your lives a lot better? And they said, you know, well, our problem is not that people are running the newest browser and it's not secure enough. It's that they haven't updated to the newest browser because, oh, it didn't work with this site or that site. And so kind of the third component of all of our work is to ensure that we're part of the Internet Explorer 8 pillar of compatibility, and that as we add new features, we're very highly compatible. And this is actually something we'll get into in kind of the design philosophies for some of our features later. Some of our security features are opt-in. You really need the website to actually participate and actively let up our security features. And the primary reason that we do that is for compatibility. So we kind of classify the attack space in kind of three major buckets. We're all about threes here. First is browser and add-on vulnerabilities. These are traditional attacks against the browsers, the things that have come out since kind of the dawn of time. The goal is generally to get remote code execution on the user's local machine with some level of permission. Still got bad guys looking there. That's kind of what they attack at the security conference that you referred to earlier. It's a big thing. but it's something that is relatively fading away compared to some of the other vectors. The middle one is social engineering, and this is the one that we've seen just a dramatic rise for. We've got a feature that we put into Internet Explorer 8 that's been far more successful than we ever planned, and we're delighted to see that, but we know that there's more to do. And we'll talk about the social engineering vector in just, you know, a few minutes. And then lastly is the web app vulnerabilities, and we've kind of hammered that on a bit. Basically, unless we can help web apps secure themselves, we're putting users at risk. So, browser and add-on vulnerabilities. First off, ActiveX, one of the most reviled technologies on the web. You know, Internet ActiveX is this huge security hole, everybody says. ActiveX is horrible. Microsoft should ditch ActiveX. The problem is people don't really understand what ActiveX is used for. They're like, hey, no other browser has ActiveX, so they're all safe, right? The reality is, well, every browser pretty much at this point has a binary extensibility technology. ActiveX is just a binary extensibility technology. They're like, I don't need ActiveX controls. I've got Flash, I've got Silverlight, I've got QuickTime, I've got all these things that provide rich content to me. All of those things are implemented in ActiveX. The problem with ActiveX is not that ActiveX is inherently unsafe. The problem is that there's a lot of controls out there that aren't very well written. Most of the major ones at this point, the ones that you've heard of, are actually pretty well written. But when you go to your computer OEM and you say, scan my machine to look for, you know, for patches or drivers that I need, that ActiveX control was probably written by some guy who's not really a normal, you know, Win32 software developer by day. They just kind of did it to, you know, maybe they're a web developer, or maybe, you know, they just threw something together with sample code they saw on the web. And so ActiveX presents a pretty significant attack surface because of this, the fact that it has a tremendous amount of power. You know, as you see from this chart, the number of ActiveX controls that have vulnerabilities that have been reported to the vulnerability reporting organizations is growing pretty dramatically, even though the number of ActiveX controls on the web has been pretty much constant. And that's because attackers, upon encountering the harder and harder platform of the web browser itself, are saying, well, how can we get code execution? Hey, if there's a popular add-on, a file compression suite drops an ActiveX control that's used internally but was never intended for the web, as long as that thing is popular, we can exploit it. And so while you'll see the number of vulnerabilities in Microsoft controls is actually quite low, the number of overall vulnerabilities reported is quite high. And so this is one of the things that we looked at when we said, okay, well, what can we do about the ActiveX problem? In Internet Explorer 7, we took a big crack at this. What we did is we introduced what's called the ActiveX opt-in feature. The ActiveX opt-in feature is something that by default disables most of the ActiveX controls on the computer and prevents them from running within the browser. And the reason for that is a typical Windows system with a full Office suite and a usual component of shareware and other wares that are shipped from major OEMs will often have about 100 ActiveX controls on the machine. The significant majority of those were never actually intended to run in the browser. ActiveX is a component technology that's used by lots of different products. So what we did in IE7 is by default, except for the top controls which we know are intended for use on the web, things like, you know, Flash, QuickTime, and so forth, they are disabled by default in the browser. So if you visit a website that tries to activate one of these latent ActiveX controls, rather than it running automatically and silently, we just pop a little information bar saying, hey, this website wants to use this ActiveX control. Do you want to allow that to happen? And what we do is we reduce the drive-by attacks, the attack surface of the browser, significantly by reducing the number of ActiveX controls that are available. But one of the problems that we ran into is it turns out this doesn't go far enough. And the reason it doesn't go far enough is because there are some ActiveX controls that are really meant for the web, installed through the browser. A popular web portal, again, they shipped an ActiveX control a few years ago that was for their music engine. You go to their website and it plays music from their catalog, and they had a deal with a major music distributor and so forth. The problem is that ActiveX control was meant for the web, but only meant for use on their one site. Well, we have a technology called SiteWalk, which is intended for that, where when you build an ActiveX control, we ask you to use SiteWalk so that it can only be used on your website. The problem is the uptake of SiteWalk is very low. You know, while these ActiveX control vulnerabilities could be dramatically curtailed by ensuring those ActiveX controls are only intended to run from the sites that they're intended to, the developers weren't using SiteLock. So one of the features we've introduced for Internet Explorer 8 is called Implicit SiteLock or Per-Site ActiveX. What this feature does is, by default, any ActiveX control installed through the browser is only available from the site that gave it to you. So when you go to your OEM vendor that installed your computer system and you say, scan for new patches or scan for updates or find out what hardware is compatible, that ActiveX control is only available from that site. If any other site tries to use it, they get the prompt again that says, hey, this site wants to use the, you know, the system profiler control from this company. Do you want to allow it? And by default, the control doesn't run. So again, reducing the attack surface against ActiveX vulnerabilities. Now, there's two features that have existed forever in ActiveX controls. First is called kill bits. where if a company inadvertently releases a control that has a security bug, they can go to the Microsoft Security Response Center and say, hey, oops, we goofed, we shipped this control, it has a bug, would you please kill it for us? And ActiveX Killbit will go down through Windows Update and prevent that control from running in any browser on any version of Internet Explorer. And the second is called iObject Safety. Before we run an ActiveX control, we say, hey, ActiveX control, are you safe to run from the web? And the ActiveX control has to come back and say yes or no. The reason that this alone isn't enough to mitigate all these vulnerabilities is very often the people that build these controls in the first place don't actually know that their control is unsafe, and they say, of course we're safe for use on the web, when in reality they're not. And so that's why those two features on the left are sort of the defense in depth mitigations. They're available in all browser platforms for Internet Explorer. But the new features we've added on the right are really important ones for reducing attack surface. So here's just kind of a screenshot. This thing is trying to use a shim control, and you know, I can decide whether or not I want to run this control or not. Now, the problem with this is, okay, say the user clicks through all the prompts. They say, you know what, I want this control. Or it's a popular control like Flash or Silverlight. I want this control to run from every site. Don't prompt me. It's good. I'm happy with it. Well, one of the things that we can do in the browser is we can shield ActiveX controls and the browser itself from the most common memory-related vulnerabilities that are exploited by bad guys in the wild today. So there's a feature called DEPNX, Data Execution Prevention, or No Execute. What DEPNX does is, in memory, your system's processor, all the modern processors made in the past couple of years, have the ability to determine this page of memory, this page of data, is intended to be code executed by the processor, or this page of memory is intended to be data that's acted upon by that code. By flagging these pages differently, what we're able to do is prevent the most common types of buffer overflows, heap attacks, and so forth, where what the bad guy does is there's some buffer that's supposed to hold 256 bytes of data. He shoves, you know, 10K of data in it and blows a buffer, and now we've got code execution. But using DEPNX, we're actually able to prevent this type of thing. This feature was enhanced for Internet Explorer 8. It was in IE7 on Vista, but it was off by default because it wasn't compatible enough. For Vista SP1, XPSP3, Windows 7, Windows Server 2008, the kernel team actually made a way for us to use this feature that's more compatible. So it's on by default in IE8 on these platforms. So even if there's a vulnerability in the ActiveX control that Microsoft didn't write, we're actually able to shield exploit of that vulnerability by preventing code execution. Now, this isn't a panacea. It's not going to fix everything. It's not going to fix an ActiveX control that's got a method which is like download file to local machine and run. You know, those types of ActiveX controls have to be dealt with via Killbits or per-site ActiveX and the like. But this is something that enables even the controls that are trying to do their best for security an additional safety net. If a control causes a crash, DEPNX crash, or even if there's a buffer overflow or other handling vulnerability in Internet Explorer itself, we'll actually close that page and we'll say, hey, the data execution prevention feature had noted that we're attempting to execute data. That's not allowed, and so we're going to disable it. And so this is a feature which is highly compatible with the web today. If you see one of these crashes, chances are quite good that it's a vulnerability in a third-party ActiveX control. But this is a protection that will help protect against kind of those memory-related attacks. And so the conference you cited earlier, this feature actually prevented code execution in that case on that platform. And so we're raising the bar against attackers with these technologies. And DEP alone isn't the only one. There's a technique in Vista called address space layout randomization, which makes it a lot harder for bad guys to predict where the code is going to be loaded. And then some exception handling things, safe SEH, GS, and so forth. Yes, so there's a different kind of code security and managed code because kind of they've got their own IL and their own virtual machine and so forth. This is something that actually works with the processor directly. And so the processor has this flag that says, is this code or is this data? Within a structure like .NET, you actually have the ability to do that at the IL level and so forth. But yes, this alphabet soup is all about helping prevent these types of traditional browser add-on vulnerabilities from getting exploited by bad guys. So, kind of moving along in that topic, you know, I talked about how, wow, people really try to write good code, but, you know, sometimes they don't. So the question for the audience is, what's the best way to develop secure, performant, reliable C and C++ code? Sorry? No memory leak, sure. So making sure that you have code quality is one way, but, you know, as we've seen, that's actually something that turns out to be pretty hard. The answer is don't. You know, basically within the browser, we have a lot of extensibility points based around native code. The problem is, while they're tremendously powerful, they're a huge source of security, performance, and reliability problems. So whatever we can do in the browser to prevent people from having to write that kind of native code that's so difficult to write, we're doing our users a great service. And we're also going to make these guys happier, because very often, if you've got a web developer, he doesn't want to go dig into the internals of COM. He just wants to do something non-binary to extend his site and make it more sticky. And since I saw Giorgio a couple of minutes ago and he was giving his session, you've already seen all this, so I'm going to go through it really quickly. But, you know, the first is accelerators. Obviously, you have the ability with a non-binary mechanism to exploit, to make your service available to users no matter where they go on the web. You know, previously, if you wanted to do something like this, you had to create some COM objects, you had to hook some Internet Explorer interfaces, and you had to run your code basically everywhere the user went on the web. Even if they weren't using your service, you'd have to, on every time they navigated, you'd have to go hook up your event handler. On every time they clicked the menu, you'd have to hook up your event handler. Your code was running all the time and potentially incurring a performance, a security, and a reliability cost on the user. With accelerators, we've taken all that work out of your hands. You just write some non-binary code, and now you're good to go. Similarly, web slices, you've got the ability to just go out and write your web slice, expose content within the favorites bar. You don't need to do any additional work around writing native code. Previously, people would write toolbars whose sole purpose was to just kind of show something from their site. So monitor X or Y on my site. They'd have to go write native code. They have to write a bunch of networking code to go pull stuff down. They're like, why don't you just let me put a web page up there? Well, web slices are all about that. And then lastly is visual search suggestions. Previously, one of the very popular things that people would do is they'd go write these toolbars that just provided search for their one website. And for users, you know, it's kind of funny, some of the comical things you could see out there on Flickr and so forth were people whose entire screen was filled up with search toolbars, and then a little bitty bitty thing at the bottom that was like, you know, where they could actually see the web page. And some of those were just jokes, but some of them actually, we went on a site visit to a major pharmaceutical company on the East Coast, and, you know, we go there and we look and half their screen was toolbars. And they didn't really know how they got there, and they kind of used them from time to time, but mostly all they did was kind of crash the user's browser. But because the browser wasn't like, hey, this guy's crashing you all the time, please stop running it, you know, users didn't know. And so with visual search suggestions in our new search box in IE8, you're able to build the power that previously required a toolbar to have. And now you can just put it in, use an XML format, use standard, you know, web technologies, JSON, XML, and so forth, to put your content up there. User only has one box. There's no performance hit. You know, it only runs when user's actually using the search box. It's a significant improvement. And by doing these three technologies, while we're actually increasing the number of features of the browser, effectively we're going to decrease the attack surface for almost every user because they don't need these third-party plugins that were previously written in native code and unstable and had to be updated and non-performant and so forth. They can actually just take the slices, the accelerators, and visual search. If they don't like it, they can just right-click on it and choose delete. You know, it just goes away. It's much easier to manage, and the installation process is simpler as well. You know, basically you get kind of a clearly worded prompt of what you're being asked to install, and you can remove it whenever you want. Have a new manage add-ons interface. I don't know if you guys have seen this previously in any of your earlier talks. We had a manage add-ons interface in IE6. It was miserable. A little bit better in IE7. One of the important things that we added in IE8 is we show more types of extensions. So in particular, we show the search providers and the accelerators. We also show your in-private filtering list, and we'll talk about what in-private is shortly. One of the key things I love about the new interface is there's a column on the right called load time. The load time column allows you to see, hey, which of my add-ons is slowing down my browser experience? We've got a popular, very popular extension that we saw that, you know, one of their add-ons takes about 1.5 seconds to initialize on every tab creation. User clicks new tab, 1.5 seconds later, a new tab opens. If you look in the Manage Add-ons experience, you'll see that the load time for that extension is, you know, 1.4 seconds. So the vast majority of the time that Internet Explorer is waiting during startup of a new tab or startup of the browser itself is actually caused by an add-on that just isn't very well performing. And so by adding this column, we're able to bring awareness to users, and they can actually push on the vendor and say, hey, I'm going to uninstall your add-on unless you can give me a better performance experience. So, you know, kind of the last thing that we, I think it's the last thing we're going to talk about is protected mode. So protected mode is a feature that was, yes? Yes. Who manages the add-on?
Yeah, it will be managed by Microsoft. It will be managed by our IT team.
Sorry. Microsoft is the viewer for plans that are currently installed within Internet Explorer. If you're in a corporation and you want to control what add-ons are available to your user or control their ability to add new add-ons or their ability to configure the add-ons that are there, all of these things are group policy controllable. So you as an organization can remain in control. And for if in a tightly locked down environment, managed add-ons basically kind of becomes a read-only view to the consumer of, here's what your IT department has set up. If you don't like these, you know, go talk to your IT department. But this is not kind of a Microsoft managed thing. We just provide data. You have the ability, there's a link that says search for this add-on by your default search provider. So if you want more information about something, you can go there. There's also a link to go get more toolbars and add-ons, which is, again, controlled by the IT department if they want, which will bring you out to ieaddons.com, which is a new site that we're building out that has a lot of slices, accelerators, and legacy types of add-ons using native code. Protected mode, feature we introduced in Internet Explorer 7. This kind of pairs nicely with DepNX. Probably should have put the slide before, but protected mode is really all about if there is code execution, let's make sure that the user doesn't lose the machine. So hacker finds some way to get around DepNX, finds some way to get around per-site ActiveX or whatever technology, manages to get his code running within the process. Internet Explorer 7 on Vista and above introduced a feature called protected mode. Protected mode means that the tab and the add-ons that it runs within a restricted write sandbox that doesn't have the ability to modify the system. So you have the ability to, you know, run your code at this low integrity level, but you're not running as the user, you're not running as admin. On Vista and above, admins ordinarily run as normal users. And on Vista and above in protected mode, however, web pages don't even run with the user's permission. So, you know, they can't go delete all the documents in your My Documents folder. They can't go put malware in your startup folder. They can't start new services. They can't go manipulate any of your desktop or other applications because they're within this protected mode sandbox. Sandboxing is very tricky to get right because of the compatibility cost of doing so, but it's something that is, you know, we shipped it in 7. We continue to support it in 8. We've introduced a couple of new features in 8 to make it work a little bit better. One of the big things that we did is we made it so when you cross between integrity levels, we no longer pop new windows all the time. And this is a side effect of our new loosely coupled architecture that allows an outside, basically the IE window, which runs as the normal user with medium write, host tabs of different integrity levels, so low integrity sandboxes for internet content and medium integrity sandboxes for intranet or trusted zone content. And so we're able to do that and actually improve the user experience for the user. We've got a couple other helper things for APIs, but most of this is not actually terribly interesting to the general public. The kind of the message for the general public is, hey, there's a sandbox mode that helps protect you from malicious content on the web, even if it bypasses all the other protection. And so sandboxing is a great feature for IE. The last thing I think, I'm pretty sure this is the last one, is application protocols. Previously, we had this ability where your browser could launch an application protocol handler. And so this wasn't ActiveX. They could actually just send a message to another app on your system by using what's called an app protocol. So the America Online Instant Messenger protocol has existed since, I think, 1996, where you could go to a website and click on a link, and it would go load the AOL Instant Messenger thing and send a message to your friend. Well, the problem is, basically, you're passing untrusted data directly from the Internet into this other application, which in theory, when it registered for this protocol, it should have been aware that, hey, this content isn't trustworthy, I shouldn't, you know, interpret it blindly. Unfortunately, the reality is most of those things were not terribly well written, and so you had the ability for untrusted data to go corrupt the medium rights process. So one of the things that we've introduced for Internet Explorer 8 is an application protocol prompt. So before we kick off another application out of web content, we'll actually notify the user and ask them, hey, this site wants to open this program. Would you like to use this? On Vista and above, we kind of had the protected mode elevation dialogue, but it required that the user have protected mode enabled, and it was only available for Vista and above. This will help shield users on XP. It also provides a little more context about why the application wants to run. Rather than just saying, hey, OneNote wants to run, it's going to say, hey, foobar.org tried to launch OneNote with the following URL, and the user can make a security decision based on that. The slide deck keeps getting longer and longer. The last thing that I was going to mention is the file upload control. Previously, we had this problem where when you chose to upload a file to a website, that website would get the full path of that file in your local system, which could represent an information disclosure problem to the user because essentially, you know, see users Eric Law desktop secret plan to win X market plan.txt, you know, if I was to upload that to some site, they could actually get that full file path. They would know that my user account was named Eric Law, my system account was on the C drive, and so forth. And so in IE8, we've changed that so they only get the leaf file name. They basically just get file.zip in this case. Also, importantly, the text box here is read-only. And this is something that matches all the other current version browsers. This is done both for user experience reasons, because previously if you typed a file path in this box that didn't exist, the form would throw an exception. The user would never get any notice, and it just wouldn't work. But also more importantly, because the bad guys keep attacking file upload control. And pretty much every major browser version since the file upload control was introduced, bad guys have found a way to trick the user into typing a path into that control or pushing a path into that control that they didn't want, allowing file theft attacks. And so we've just finally closed that vector down for good. The user wants to upload a file, they click the browse button, pick the file, and they're good to go. Okay. So all of that, you know, native code, goodness, you know, helping protect the user from local system attacks. Moving on to social engineering. Social engineering is kind of a great one because there's no problem. There's no easy solution to it. I can't go install a new firmware in my parents and just, you know, have them be secure, right? I can go and say, you know, don't click on that link or don't go to sites that you don't trust. And it's kind of like, well, you know, sites you don't trust, I trust. Well, should I trust anything? Fortunately, my mom has my homepage as her homepage, and she doesn't really know how to go anywhere else, so I'm kind of safe from that. But my brother doesn't have the same thing. So the problem is, you know, what's the problem? The problem is in the real world, threats are usually pretty obvious. And so, you know, if you see a boat full of alligators, you're not going to go step in that boat, right? Well, attackers, you know, previously, websites would look like the boat full of alligators, and you'd be like, oh, I'm not touching anything here. The problem is attackers are getting better and better, and they're hiding their attack. They're making them harder to detect, and so they're coming up with more and more convincing ways to get the user to install malicious code on their system. And I've got a couple of examples in the next slide. Now, here's one. I got an important Facebook message that told me one of my friends was doing some sort of exotic dance, and I needed to go look at this because it was great. And, you know, oh, when I go there, it says, please download the Flash movie player. You know, you need Flash 11 to see this. For those of the web devs in the audience, you know, Flash 10 is the latest one. But, you know, a normal user who's excited about the prospect of this thing might go install that add-on. And, of course, the add-on isn't really from Adobe, and it's not really Flash. And while exciting things will happen, there are things that you really don't want having happen to your system. And so this is an example that's become very popular, this kind of social networking malware where it spreads via social networks or attempts to emulate a social network. This is the one that got my brother. Basically, you know, he was surfing some music lyric site and got a pop-up that said, hey, you know, you can't use our website anymore because we've detected you have a virus. If you want to continue to use our website, you've got to go uninstall this virus. And so they bring you to a very convincing-looking page that says, oh, you know, we're scanning your system. Oh, we found all these threats. And incidentally, we found all this porn, and we're going to tell your wife, so you really want to go uninstall this. And, you know, users are like, oh, geez, I got to get rid of this as quickly as possible. I can't believe my real antivirus program didn't, or my antivirus program that's already installed didn't find it. Good thing this website saved me. And so these fake antivirus and fake utilities things are becoming very common ways of exploiting the user, because the user at this point is like, oh, geez, I've already been exploited. What, you know, I can't get any worse. Let me go install this program, and maybe I'll be okay. And then if not, you know, I'll call my brother and say, hey, I installed this antivirus, and my system doesn't seem to be working very well. And so, you know, why does this happen? I love this picture because, you know, I took it at the beach in Hawaii, and one of the signs says no swimming, right? Very clear, unambiguous message, says don't do this, right? Doesn't provide a lot of context of why, but it's a very clear message. Sign on the left says basically strong current, which is good because it tells you what you have to be afraid of. But then it's got the little footer which says, if in doubt, don't go out, which kind of says, up to you. We don't know. Make your own decision, right? And so this is really, to me, what Internet Explorer used to do. You have this executable, and we say, files from the Internet can be useful, but they can harm your computer. You decide, right? And so the problem is we're delegating this trust decision to the user, and they may have no context under which to make the decision. And if they just got a big scary, like, hey, you've got a virus, you need to install this antivirus, they might just say, why? I guess I should install it, right? Somebody told me to. It seemed believable. The graphics look good. There's quotes from PC Magazine that were never made saying it was a great antivirus tool. It's the best. And so I'm going to run it. Well, we need something that's more effective. Here's another warning on a different beach in Hawaii. This is the number of people who have died on this beach, right? And it's got those little tick marks, right? And if you look closely, you'll see the colors of the tick marks are different, because some of them are really old, and some people have recently died on this beach. And you look at this and you think, I'm not going to go near the water because I understand how dangerous it is. It's not ambiguous. It's not like, hey, you know, maybe you don't want to, you know, look at the water, try to decide. It's like, you will die if you swim here. And so, to me, this is an inspiration for what we need to do in the browser to prevent malware from getting installed. And we got fairly close to that. You know, rather than sort of the ambiguous, we don't know, you know, make your own decision, got a nice big red warning, hey, this thing's been reported as unsafe, file your downloading is unsafe, links to viruses, harm your computer, cancel this download. By default, the only button is cancel. There's a link which is, you know, basically shoot myself in the foot. For a variety of reasons, we have to have a shoot yourself in the foot link. But the important point here is, you know, talking about taking a user out of the trust equation, in a corporate environment, the IT admin can actually take away that link. So you can actually keep your network safe from malicious software by actually using group policy to say, you know what, I think the guys that are, you know, professionally staffing this Microsoft Malware Prevention Center are doing a pretty good job. Their false positive rate is basically non-existent. So I'm going to remove that link because I trust Microsoft to help protect my users. And so you can actually remove that link. User can't install malware on your network, and you don't have to go spend a couple hours cleaning off their machine later. Similarly, if you go to a page that is, you know, containing lots of different malicious software, or if it's a long-lived page, so like Perfect Defender 2009, it's been up for a couple of months, and everybody that goes there gets malware, this is the experience that you get. Rather than a direct file download, you get a full page blocking saying, hey, this website's been reported as unsafe. The only link that's available by default is go to my homepage instead. User has to kind of tunnel into the more information and scroll past all the reasons why they're going to lose their machine to get to the link that says disregard and continue. And back to the beginning, if the IT admin has said, essentially, don't allow users to bypass these warnings, that disregard and continue link totally goes away. And so through this experience, we're able to help protect the user. I'm going to see whether or not I can quickly just go give you a little demo of this guy. Tailspin Toys is our sort of crash test dummy site. We've got a malicious demo application, so I'm going to go ahead and choose this guy, and I'm going to say, hey, I want to open it. Oh, download's been reported as unsafe. Don't do that. You know, got to click cancel by default. And so through this mechanism, you know, it's not much of a demo. Look, nothing bad happened. Usually when you go to hacker conferences, all they want to do is see things explode and catch on fire. And so when you show demos of, like, nothing happens, only the IT people are like, ooh, I want that. How do I get that? So it's kind of fun to talk to a mixed audience this time. I'm sorry? Okay. So one of the things that we've been talking about recently is basically that not all malware protection is created equal. And this is, you know, the reality is that browsers have different levels and different data providers. Microsoft actually spends a ton of money on getting our malware data. And we've got lots of great anti-malware sources, including things like Windows Defender that report to us when users encountered a malicious software problem. And we've got, you know, different other vectors for getting this information. So we're building upon the URL reputation service that we first built out with Internet Explorer 7 for phishing, where we go out and we pay lots of people for data around the phishing sites in the world. We've extended that. We've added in new data providers that are providing us malware information. And then we have folks with the Microsoft Malware Prevention Center and so forth that are actually going out and catching those sites too. So this is a NSS study which was done about a week and a half, or it was released about a week and a half ago, of the effective catch rates of different browsers. One of the interesting things upon seeing this, everybody looks at it and says, oh, look, Internet Explorer 7 prevents malware, but you guys didn't have a malware prevention feature. What's the story there? And the reality is bad guys are sort of equal opportunity offenders, and these were phishing sites that were also hosting malware, and so they were blocked because they were phishing sites. But, you know, it's like 4%. Whereas Internet Explorer 8's protection at the time that we ran the study and released candidate 1 was roughly 70%, which is 2 to 4 times that of other browsers. But of course we're not going to stop because, you know, 70% is not 100%. We're never going to get to 100% because the nature of the threat is always changing. The bad guys are always coming up with new ways and new sites to get across. But we are going to bring on new data providers and new data sources and try and get that number even higher. So some of the other features we've done are really about helping users who are fairly savvy get even more savvy. And so one of the features is domain highlighting. Domain highlighting helps the user understand what website they're at by bolding the part of the URL that's security relevant. And so I click on every fish I ever get, and some of the fishing guys have gotten smart to that and have tracking to see who are the idiots out there that click on fish. So I get maybe 10 or 15 phishing messages a day. So I get to see all the tricks the bad guys are playing. One of them that they've been using is they'll come up with a misleading URL where they'll take a legitimate URL, you know, paypal.com, and they'll stick that out in front of their phishing URL. And so, you know, still go to the site. The user still sees the paypal.com that they trust in the address bar, but it's in the wrong place. So in this case down here, you've got paypal.com, and, you know, this is kind of a contrived, not really .fisher.org. But as you can see, the browser is actually highlighting the fisher.org part of the URL because that's the part that's relevant for a security decision. And so users who understand the concept of domain names are more able to see what part of the domain name is the part that actually represents the security relevant component. But again, you know, this is really for people who kind of know what they're doing. It's really an aid for them. You know, the phishing filter and the smart screen malware filter are really where we're going to get most of the protection for most normal users. Yes. So the question was, when you hover over a link and look down in the status bar, is the domain highlighting applied there? And the answer is no. And it's really kind of a subtle and interesting reason, because there's kind of this folk wisdom of, hey, look at the status bar to see where the link is going to decide whether or not you want to go there. The problem is, that can be very deceptive. In every web browser, there's a way to trick that. So when the user hovers over something, they think they're going to one site, but in reality, they end up on another site. The other thing that you'll very often see is you'll see a redirector or sort of an innocuous URL where it's like, you know, tinyurl.com or something like that, and you say, that looks okay, or I can't tell. And so we basically say the status bar is not a security device. You shouldn't use it as one. Certainly, you know, you can take a quick look and see whether or not it's something totally unreasonable. But because it's entirely spoofable, we really don't want users looking down there. What we want them to look at is the address bar, because the address bar is non-spoofable. UI can't overlay it. You can't put a fake address bar on the top because we have restrictions that prevent where windows appear. The status bar, one of the key things is that basically the user could have turned the status bar off, but a malicious website could actually draw in a fake status bar at the bottom and fool users with it. And so the status bar really isn't a security feature, and so for that reason we don't have it there. I think it would be cool if we just kind of did it everywhere we show a URL because, you know, at least we can help a little bit, but no, it's not in the status bar. International domain names. So, you know, for the U.S. audience, we're typically using, you know, URLs that are A to Z, 0 to 9, dash. These are kind of the host names that are allowed within normal DNS. But it turns out that the rest of the world isn't satisfied with our very limited alphabet. They want to build sites out that use international characters within URLs. One of the problems with this is international character sets include characters very often that look exactly like their U.S. English or ASCII equivalent. And so, for instance, we had a spoof a couple of years ago where somebody built out a site that was paypal.com, but the A's were actually Cyrillic characters. They look identical to U.S. ASCII English characters, but they're in Cyrillic. And so if you looked at paypal.com within your address bar, it would look identical, pixel for pixel perfect, against the real site from the phishing site. So what we did in 97 when we built out international domain names is we built support to determine what the user's local character set is, and actually if they're using characters in the host name that are not part of that user's character set, we'll render them in their encoded form, which is called Punicode. And what this does is it reduces the attack surface for these international domain names down to essentially very, very targeted markets. You can't spoof the user in the U.S. with a Cyrillic character. You can't spoof a user in Japan with a Greek character. And so by doing this, we're able to reduce the attack surface pretty significantly. We did this, and you know, I thought the attack was going to go away because we came out with this protection before really any of these international domain names became very popular. And so I thought, bad guys aren't even going to try this. Well, one of the security conferences we went to recently, actually, they were actually doing this attack, and they had some lookalike URLs, but they just did all their demos in Firefox. They conveniently forgot to mention that, oh, these things don't actually work within IE. So it's kind of annoying being in my position sometimes. But our IDN work, I think, was great, and it continues on in IE8. Extended validation certificates, you saw them earlier. You guys clearly already know what EV certs are. Basically, a website can go through a more rigorous authentication process to show that they're a legitimate website, they've got a legitimate business model. They're actually registered in the organization where in the jurisdiction that they exist. And so here's an example, you know, Microsoft.com's has a green bar experience. This is supported by Internet Explorer 7 and later, Firefox 3 and later, Opera, Chrome, Safari, so all the current browser versions support it. And now we have over 10,000 sites that have EVE certificates. Question in the back?
Since this seems so related to the domain name, how are you supporting DNS SAC or that new encryption of DNS names?
So the overall question, I think, is does Internet Explorer support DNSSEC? And really, the real question is, you know, what does support DNSSEC? So DNSSEC will not be supported by the browser itself. What will happen is DNSSEC will be enforced by the platform. And so basically, you know, one of the goals of DNS, DNS is the system by which host names and domain names get turned into the IP addresses that are reached. That system is insecure, and there's a few people out there that have been trying to hack the system and basically create forged records and so forth. Where EVSSL has value, essentially, is by preventing DNS poisoning attacks from fooling the user. So even if I poison your DNS server and say, hey, paypal.com should resolve to my other host name, the validation that's done before an EV certificate prevents essentially third parties from going and getting an EV cert from you know, network solution from VeriSign and so forth. And so even if I'm in a coffee shop with a poison DNS server, I take paypal.com in my address bar, I'm not going to be able to get that green address bar that you see at paypal.com. And so it is a mitigation for the lack of broadly deployed DNSSEC. DNSSEC as a technology is very interesting. There's lots of deployment challenges, but it's certainly something that Microsoft and others in the industry are looking to see, you know, basically looking forward to supporting in the future, because you can do some really cool things with DNSSEC. One of the proposals, for instance, is you could in your DNSSEC record say, my website should only ever be addressed over HTTPS, and that would actually protect against some of the attacks that we've seen at security conferences recently and so forth. So, yes, we're looking to the platform for that kind of support. Could you do that by giving nomination to a trusted website? Really what it comes down to is how do you identify the trusted website? And today, unfortunately, because of the way DNS works, address records are not trusted, so they're not signed. And so what this means is that you can't actually know whether or not the address you get back from DNS is really right. The principle behind DNSSEC is that you actually use certificates and signing to actually sign records. So basically everything chains back to the trusted DNS route. So if you trust VeriSign for .com, basically you can verify that any given DNS record that you get back actually is legitimate. And that's kind of the idea of DNSSEC. Now, I talked earlier about taking the user out of the equation. One of our top group policy or our top IT manager requests is basically don't make my users make security decisions. We have 1,477 group policy controls within Internet Explorer 8. So if you really want to, you can micromanage your user experience and ensure, you know, they're only going to the sites that you want, only have the plugins installed that you want. You can get very, very fine-grained control over their browsing experience and make it so they don't have to make security decisions. You don't have, you know, your secretaries or your line-level IT workers making security decisions that could potentially put your entire network at risk. Okay, web application vulnerabilities. So I'm, you know, kind of most excited about this area because we spent a ton of time here. The threat landscape. This is a study from August of last year from a company called White Hat Security. They do basically audits and penetration tests of websites. And they did some data reporting of what types of vulnerabilities they found in websites. And they found that basically 70% of the sites that they surveyed had a cross-site scripting vulnerability. There are a bunch of other different types of vulnerabilities, but basically a dominant majority of sites have a cross-site scripting problem. Well, why do we care? Cross-site scripting is basically, our security researcher Brian Sullivan calls it the new buffer overflow. And the reason is not that it has anything to do with memory-related attacks, but because as an attacker, you can do the same kinds of things that you could have previously done with a buffer overflow against the client, but now you can do it against websites. You can steal the user's cookies or credentials. You can log their keystrokes. You can deface the sites that they're on. You can launch cross-site request forgery. You can circumvent phishing filters. You can abuse browser add-ons. You can do all kinds of things with these cross-site scripting attacks. And so because so much of the security attack surface of the browser is domain-related, if I'm on paypal.com and I get the green bar, that's great. Well, if paypal.com had a cross-site scripting vulnerability, a bad guy could get his code inside paypal.com too, the green bar is not going to go away. And so while cross-site scripting is a website vulnerability, we in the browser have the ability to potentially mitigate that. And so I'm going to do a demo of the cross-site scripting filter really quickly. Some of you folks may have seen this before, but it's kind of fun. So I'm going to start out here. Now I'm going to go turn off the security feature because when the security feature is on, again, it's not really cool to do a demo where you say, look, nothing happened. So we're going to scroll down and we're going to find the enable cross-site scripting filter feature. We have so many different security settings, kind of hard to turn it off. Enable XSS filter, we're going to choose disable. You really want to do this, shoot yourself in the foot? Yes, I want to shoot myself in the foot. Okay. And so basically here I'm on Hotmail and I've gotten the link off to my bank, Microsoft's dummy bank, woodgrovebank.com, .co.uk actually, sorry, we're a British bank. And so basically, you know, here's my bank's website. I look at the address, I look at the domain highlighting, it's woodgrovebank.co.uk, which is my trusted URL that I expect. You know, it's not HTTPS, but, you know, we're actually too cheap to buy a certificate for the demo. But the point is it could well be HTTPS and so forth. Right now there's no indication at all that anything has gone wrong. But the reality is there's something very interesting that's happened to this website that the user can't perceive. So I'm going to click on account login, and we're going to type my username and password and see what happens. So I'm going to go ahead and type my account number as 1234, and I'm going to type my secret password. Oh, something interesting has happened. Now, of course, a bad guy isn't really going to use DHTML to inject a picture of himself and your secret information. What he's going to do is he's going to leak that information back to his website using a covert channel. So the user has no idea that they're being monitored as they interact with the application. And the reason that they're able to do that, essentially, is because the bad guy has done something rather clever. He's found a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the Woodgrove Bank website that allows him to inject his script into the legitimate site. So let's take a closer look at what's going on with this page. You see the SID part here with all these percent encoded characters? That's the XSS site. What's happened is the Woodgrove Bank site has actually inadvertently put this part of the URL into its page in a way that it can be executed as script. And so if we actually use our new cool, source viewer within Internet Explorer 8, we're going to scroll all the way down to the bottom. We're going to see a little block of code that says script for window, event on load, source equals hacker site, snoop.js. And so the bad guy has managed to get this website to include a reference to a script running from his site. And so he's able to do all this malicious stuff. Now let's go take a look at what actually happens with Internet Explorer 8 in the default configuration. We're going to go reset our security settings to the default level. And then we're going to try and run the exploit again. Minor difference here. Page looks pretty much the same. URL still the same. No blocking experience, no questions asked of the user. Oh my goodness, we've detected cross-site scripting. What do you want to do? Ah, panic, get out of here. Basically, we know that users don't understand what cross-site scripting is. Heck, most web developers don't understand what it is, or they wouldn't have these problems to begin with. So we very, 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 very subtly modify the page. What we do, first, we notify the user via an information bar that we've made a modification to the page. One of the reasons is because otherwise this demo is almost impossible to do because you say, look, nothing happened. And they're like, but literally nothing happened. The other reason is this gives the web developer the opportunity to understand if the behavior of their page has changed. But if we go ahead and look at the source of this, and we can actually do the login, you're not going to see anything happen. And so if we look at the source of this page, you're going to find a very, very minor modification is made where instead of script for window, you get SC pound IPT for window. And what's happened here is Internet Explorer has detected this reflected cross-site scripting vulnerability. We've detected an outbound script from one site going into a different site, and that response coming back to the client, we've got a little flow chart here, coming back to the client is an executable script block, and we've said, that looks really, really dangerous. So we've sanitized it. What we've done is we've neutered part of the response. We made a very minor modification. And so what we do is we come up with, you know, we detect in the outbound request this script block, and then we generate a signature that will match that. So we're going to look for that signature in the response. And upon encountering that signature, we're going to neuter it. We're going to make a very minor change to it. Now, the reason that this is important is because, you know, we could try and block the user completely, but what if it was like a site that was submit your favorite JavaScript? And you go to send a bunch of JavaScript to this site, and now Internet Explorer is like, and freaks out. You don't want that. You want the browser to pretty much work as expected. There's no danger in sending JavaScript to a website. There's danger if one website sends JavaScript to another website, and that JavaScript comes back in a way that it's going to be executed. And so Internet Explorer very surgically understands this and only makes the minor modification. And the value here is that we can turn it on by default because it's highly compatible. there's cross-site scripting filters that are available for other browsers as plugins, but the problem is they're not available. They're not installed by default, because if they did, they would break websites. And so by doing this in such a compatible way, we can have it turned on by default and protect users from the dominant types of cross-site scripting vulnerabilities today. We've done a ton of other work around attack surface reduction for cross-site scripting, because there's other types of cross-site scripting that are less common. There's stored cross-site scripting attacks. There's what's called DOM-based cross-site scripting attacks and so forth. And so we've done a bunch of work to reduce attack surface, such that even without the filter, Internet Explorer 8 has a significantly reduced attack surface for cross-site scripting attacks. We've disabled some code pages that were previously problematic and pretty much only used by bad guys, US ASCII and UTF-7 sniffing. We've fixed some inheritance bugs around interactions of frames. We've disabled what are called CSS expressions within IE8 standards mode. So previously you were able to run JavaScript out of an expression in a CSS. So people weren't expecting script injection into their CSS, and so they very often had vulnerabilities. So for performance and security attack surface reasons, we've disabled CSS expression. We've also built some new AJAX filters, features that allow for safer mashups, and we're going to talk about those. How are mashups built today? The most common thing that we see in mashups is cross-domain script inclusion. I say basically script type equals JavaScript, and my source is going to be syndication.example.com, whackpageadd, whackshowadds.js. This is a mashup. Now, it's not a mashup in the sense of, you know, kind of a cool housing maps mashup. This is the dominant mashup, which is I want to put third-party ads within my page because I want to get paid. Well, the problem is that most people don't really give a lot of thought to is when you do a mashup in this way, where you inject a script from a different site, you have to completely and fully trust that site, not to do anything malicious now or in the future. And so in some cases, if it's a major, you know, ad provider or something, maybe you do trust it. But for other cases, maybe it's on your, like, sort of My Yahoo homepage where you want to pull in some gadget from some other site. Well, Yahoo can't trust that any gadget you might want to pull in is not going to try and steal your credential. And so this type of thing is very dangerous. A script manager tag using like ASP.NET AJAX or things like that. Fundamentally, the script manager tag will end up generating something like this, where it's just across the main script inclusion. So you have to be very careful about whose scripts you choose to endorse by putting them in your page. And so in the cases where you have to put an untrusted script in your page, where you believe that there's, you know, good reason for it to be untrusted or whatnot, the dominant mechanism today is to use an iframe. So we're going to put an inline frame to the other site. And a lot of advertising is done this way. So for instance, you know, if your webmail provider doesn't trust the ad provider, they'll put the ad within an iframe in the page. But there's problems because while that creates an effective security boundary, it doesn't prevent the iframe from sort of manipulating the top level window and sending it somewhere else. It does prevent the sort of minor data theft issue, but what it makes really hard to do is for the advertisement to communicate to the page and vice versa. So we've done some work in Internet Explorer 8. One of the first things we added was cross-domain requests. Cross-domain requests is very similar to the XML HTTP request feature in the browser, and it allows web developers to make requests cross-domain directly without any kind of proxy or any other type of feature like that. So it's high performance. Now, ordinarily, this is a violation of the same origin policy, that security policy we talked about way back in the beginning, and so it's kind of dangerous. What we do to secure this is we essentially require the server to respond back that it understands that this is a cross-domain data access, and it's okay with that. And the syntax is basically access control allow origin, where the response from the server says, I want to allow access to my data, and it can either specify star, meaning anybody can ask me for this data, or it can specify a particular origin. So HTTPS, Microsoft.com can ask me for this data. X-domain request was put forth as essentially a public standard, so anyone can implement it. Most of the other browsers are actually currently doing something different. It's called cross-site XML HTTP request. It's similar. It has, in our opinion, a larger attack surface. But the important thing is they use the same access control mechanism. So if you're a web developer and you're building a web platform and you want to expose your data, you can just expose your data using this access control allow origin header, and you'll be compatible with IE8 and the other browsers that are implementing these standards. The other thing we've done is there's a feature in HTML5 called PostMessage. PostMessage allows two iframes to communicate back and forth directly strings very, very quickly and very safely, because essentially you can say, hey, go tell that other frame, as long as he is at the site I expect, the following message. and that friend can communicate back to the parent page, tell that parent page, if he's at the site I expect, the following message. And through this way, you've got bidirectional communication between frames in a way that's very fast and relatively secure. Now, there's a key point for all of this. Well, first off, I also mentioned that it's part of the HTML5 spec and everybody supports it now. There's a key point for all of this. I said it's relatively safe. The hole here is that you're passing data between two domains, and it's untrusted data. And so what if that other domain that you're making this request of, you know, is malicious, and they send you something that when you put it in your page is going to cause code execution? It's really dangerous. Essentially, it's a cross-site scripting hole all over again. So for IEA, we've introduced new mechanisms to allow sites to exchange data safely in this way. So here's sample code for passing message. In this case, I passed hello to recipient.example.com, and he gets to listen by saying, hey, on message, if the source domain is expected.com, then use the data. But how do you secure the data? There's two ways that you secure the data. Are you guys familiar with JavaScript object notation? JSON, JavaScript object notation, is a way to serialize a JavaScript object down to a string. And then on the other end, you can reconstitute it. The problem with JSON is the dominant way of reconstituting this data is to call eval on it. So you pass this string into eval. The problem is, if that string contains a function that executes immediately, you've got a cross-site scripting bug. You've got code execution right away. So to resolve this problem, we've introduced native JSON support within the browser. This is part of the ECMAScript 3.1 proposal. And it allows you two functions, JSON.stringify, which turns a JavaScript object into a string, sans any function. And more importantly, JSON.parse, which will take a string of JavaScript and generate an object out of it. But when it does so, it will not run any executable constructs. It will not put any executable constructs into the object. And so in this way, you're able to pass JSON messages back and forth between untrusted parties and not have to worry about any code execution. Supported natively in IE8 and Firefox 3.5, and we know the other browser vendors are working on it. So now you get into an interesting thing. What if the JSON object contains a string of HTML? The developer is going to take that string of HTML and just shove it in their page. That HTML might have scripted. What do we do now? Window.to static HTML. Window.toStaticHTML is a function. It puts forth the ability to sanitize script out of an HTML string. And so this is part of the Microsoft anti-cross-site scripting library, which is available for use on the server. We've brought it to the client side. So you can call window.toStaticHTML on a blob of on a string blob and know that what you're going to get back isn't going to be executable. And then you can safely put it in your DOM. Now, it doesn't just convert it to a plain text string because that's kind of boring. Maybe you want simple formatting like bold and, you know, things like that, underline, italicize. But this will remove the executable constructs. And so I've got a demo that puts it all together. Basically, you check for a cross-domain request object availability. If so, you go ahead and you make a request to this other weather site. You call JSON.parse to get back the JavaScript object representing the weather. And then you take that weather forecast and you call toStaticHTML on it to ensure that there's no attempt to inject script. And so using these technologies, you can build a very safe mashup from two mutually distrustful sites. I'm sorry? Sorry? Oh yeah, sure. You could use all or whatnot. I'm actually not a JavaScript programmer by trade, and some of the stuff that I've tried previously works in IE and not other browsers. So, GetElement by ED is a pretty safe choice. So, best practices for preventing these types of script injection attacks. First off, on the server side, filter with the anti-cross-site scripting library. This will help protect browsers that don't have client-side features. It'll prevent your data stores and so forth from getting corrupted with cross-site scripting attacks. Use the JSON features and toStaticHTML if available to help sanitize and reduce attack surface from script injection. Always specify an encoding on your output pages. This will prevent bad guys from doing various tricks to try and make your page appear in a different code page and do a cross-site scripting attack in a code page that you're not expecting. Use cross-domain request or post-message to help get data safely from a cross-domain. And then use HTTP-only cookies. HTTP-only cookies were a feature introduced by Internet Explorer 6 on XPSP1. Since imported to, I think, every other major browser. The idea of using HTTP-only cookies is there's some cookies that should only be available to HTTP and never to JavaScript. And by marking your cookies as HTTP-only, when you call document.cookie, those cookies will not appear in that collection. The value here is even if a bad guy manages to get script injection on your site, he can't just go send the user's cookie off to his site and steal their credentials. because essentially the cookie that's being used for auth won't be present in that string. Now, at this point, the user's browser is kind of a sock puppet browser. If he's got script execution, he can go make the request himself. But it's actually much harder to write an exploit this way. And so HTTP-only cookies are a great mitigation that's very, very quick to deploy. And it's broadly available, supported in IE6, IE7, IE8, Firefox, et cetera. Web developers in the audience, have you heard of mime sniffing? So mime sniffing is this capability of the browser. Internet Explorer has existed for a very long time at this point. And one of the problems that we had in the early days of the web is people had very lightweight HTTP servers that didn't really understand much about content types. And so they'd give the user content and say, oh, here's a plain text document, and it was an HTML page. And so in IE, we built a feature called mime sniffing. What would happen is we would look at the content and say, well, you told us it was text plain, but we looked at it and it really is HTML, so we're going to render that as HTML. Back in the very early days when nobody really kind of knew what they were doing, a lot of people building sites didn't have access to the web server themselves, you know, this feature was great. It made IE work very well with the web of the day. The problem is now, you know, attacks are much more common. Web app attacks are much more common. There's a lot of scenarios now where, you know, previously people's websites were kind of static. Like if they wanted to make a change to their website, they'd go FTP the content directly. You never pulled in content from other people on your website because there wasn't any content you wanted. Certainly people didn't upload to your website because, gee, it was really hard to write an upload acceptor. Well, the web has moved on. And now mime sniffing is actually a pretty dangerous feature to have in the browser. So for IE8, we've made a couple of changes. First off, if you tell us it's an image anything, we'll no longer sniff HTML out of it. This will secure sites like Flickr or other photo sharing sites and prevent you from ever having a case where one user uploads an HTML document claiming it's an image, and then Flickr sends it to another user and says, here's an image, and the browser says, ooh, script, let me run that. So by default, we never do that anymore. We've also added a new header, and here's where we're back to compatibility, where a site can actually specifically opt out of content type sniffing. So we have this X content type options no sniff header that allows the server to say, don't sniff my content. I'm really going to tell you what it is. And even if I'm wrong, just render it as plain text. So this is actually, it turns out Google turned this on for all of their servers. And we're starting to see some amusing things happen because sometimes they're sending us GIF files that are really PNG files. And we no longer will sniff them and determine what they really are. So they render as red X's. And the Google guys are fixing this. But this is a very valuable feature for a site that wants to very declaratively say, I know what I'm sending you. It's really an image. Don't sniff it as anything else. Or even if you're a code sharing site and you're saying, I'm sending you text plain, don't render this as HTML because the whole point is to show the user what the HTML markup is. And so the no sniff option is available. And there's also an option to force save. And so when you deliver a file, you can actually tell IE, don't allow the user to immediately open this. Force them to save it first. What this is good for is the scenario where you allow other people to upload HTML files to your website. Well, ordinarily, an HTML file running from your website will run with your security context. You don't want that. So you say, okay, content disposition attachment. Okay, we'll force the user to get the download prompt. The problem is if the user just chooses open, it's still going to run from your website. By forcing the user to save it to their desktop first, it's no longer going to run from your security context. It's going to run from their desktop. And so through these mechanisms, you're able to build sites that allow for sharing of content much more easily and safely. I'm going to do a quick demo of clickjacking because it's kind of neat. Clickjacking is this new attack. Remember back at the beginning, you had all the gears and so forth, where the web is a very complicated beast, and features interact in surprising ways. So one of the things that interacts in a surprising way is the fact that inline frames in browsers, the ability to mash up content from multiple sites, very, very powerful, very, very useful, can be very dangerous. And so here we've got a very simple sort of prototypal store. I've got some tablets from back in the early 2000s. The user can order a tablet. For the purposes of this demo, you can assume that I use this site all the time. I happen to be logged in. I've got an account. I'm a purchaser there. And so I use this site a lot, right? So here's our victim site, if you will. Now, here's the, you know, free avatar site that I want to go to for my social networking needs, where I want to put, you know, kind of things within my social profile. I want these cats or these puppy dogs and so forth. And if you're paying me a lot of attention, one of the things you might notice is the order buttons are exactly in the same places on my legitimate tablet superstore site. And there's a good reason for this, because the reality is those order buttons are on the tablet superstore site. They're in a frame in the background. And I, as an attacker, have just layered on top some pictures to cover up the fact that I'm really clicking into this background page. And so when I, the user, say, oh, I'd like that cat for my social profile, check out, what's happened is in the background, I clicked on a page to order a tablet PC. And that tablet PC page you know, they've actually got an affiliate, and this evil hacker signed up for an affiliate account. And so he's going to get $54 in commission from this site because I've just ordered a tablet PC. And so in this way, this is actually kind of a very contrived example, but we've seen real-world attacks where people will get users to reconfigure their Flash security settings or follow them on Twitter or become their friend on Facebook, all of these different kind of, you know, toy attacks. But there actually is a real security threat with this because once the bad guys start playing with this more, they can actually do some pretty compelling attacks. Our feature here is rather simple. We introduce a new way for a website. It's called X-Frame Options, it's an HTTP header, to say, I don't want my content framed ever. I don't care whether the user has script disabled. I don't care whether there's an event handler that will try and reload the page when I do my frame busting code. Basically, never ever frame my content. And so if we go and do this demo against a site that's protected, same site that's protected by the X-Frame Options header, basically what you'll see is the background site doesn't render because it's detected that it's within an inline frame, and it prevents that from happening. And what you won't see because that clever cat texture masks it is there's a link that actually allows the user to open the legitimate site in a full new browser window. By allowing the site to open in a full new browser window, we're preventing the spoofing attack because the bad guy can't overlay that new window. And so this is a very, very simple mechanism that a website can use to help prevent this type of attack. Okay, privacy, which is my final section of the day, and then we'll get into some questions. So within IE8, we've done a couple of features for privacy. Some of them are minor, some of them are very big. First one is we've offered an enhanced cleanup feature. So we had an enhanced cleanup feature in IE7. We went a step further in IE8. First thing we added is the ability to run the deletion process on every browser exit. So you can delete selected state from your machine every time you close the browser. It will use the settings shown in the settings dialog on the right. You can, you know, delete temp files, cookies, history, form data, passwords, or in private data. And so this is valuable because if you, you know, you want your browser never to maintain any form data or passwords, you can choose this option, set it to configure, and delete on exit, and then you're good to go. The other feature we've added is a very popular customer request, which is, I want to delete my browser history. I don't want these sites tracking me. I don't want sites I don't care about maintaining state about me, but I want to remain logged into the sites that I do care about. And so we've offered this new feature called Preserve Favorite Website Data. What this will do is during the deletion process, it will consult your favorites list. And if one of the things it's considering deleting is on your favorites list, it'll decide to skip over it and maintain it. And so I can remain logged into the web pages, the news websites I care about. I can remain logged into Amazon if I'd like that and so forth, while simultaneously deleting all of the state from the websites that I don't care enough about to become my favorite. And the other thing that's nice about this is it doesn't leave, you know, a completely empty history store on your machine if that's a problem for you. We had a really amusing case where someone wrote it into the IE blog and, you know, all of their history was gone. And I guess this guy's wife had decided that that meant he deleted his browsing history, and that meant he must have been going somewhere. And so he asked, you know, can you call my wife and tell her that, you know, I didn't delete my history? You know, it's really important to me. And it was kind of, you know, I felt a little bad for the guy, but at least if he uses this feature, he'll be okay because he'll still have history from the sites that he cares about. Now, talk about the in-private stable of features. In-private is, when we did our IE planning, we found that there's two kinds of major privacy that people consider. One is called over-the-shoulder privacy. I share a computer with my fiance. I share a computer with my brother. I want to keep my browsing history independent of theirs. I don't want tracks laying around on the machine. I'm planning a surprise for my, you know, fiance's our anniversary together. I don't want her to know the places I'm looking at or the gifts I'm considering. So we have a new feature called in-private browsing. It provides shared PC privacy, the ability such that browsing doesn't leave any tracks on the local machine, cookies, DOM store, cache, history entries, etc. And so this is a valuable feature for doing shared PC privacy. The other type of privacy that we have is basically what's called sort of third-party aggregation privacy. And this is basically users want some level of protection from websites that might be tracking them. Some users don't care at all. You know, if someone is tracking them in the cloud, they don't care. Hey, maybe they'll get more relevant advertising or offers or things like that. But some people care deeply because there are websites that are in a position to build up a very comprehensive profile of the user and their habits. So let's do actually just a quick in-private browsing demo. So you can do in-private browsing by launching Internet Explorer with the dash private command line. Or you can from the safety menu, you can do new private browsing session. You get pretty much your normal startup experience, except instead of your normal home page, you get a notification that in-private browsing is on. You've got this persistent identifier up here telling you that in private is configured. If I were to go to a site like Amazon.com, for instance, one of the things you'll notice is Amazon.com thinks I'm not logged in, even though actually there is a persistent cookie on my machine from Amazon identifying me. But when you start an in-private browsing session, your cookie jar starts empty. Any cookies that you get during your browsing session are treated as session cookies, so when you exit your browsing session, they're deleted. One of the other things I wanted to quickly show off, because it's kind of funny, is in-private browsing actually resolves a different security problem. And so let me start a non-in-private instance, and I'll show you one of the things. Again, talking about how complicated the browsing security model is. There's a security problem with CSS that went unnoticed for many years and is now present in every browser that supports CSS. And that's the ability to steal from the user their history. And so if I click where have you been, this site is going to tell me that I've visited NewYorkTimes.com and Live.com. How does it know that? It shouldn't be able to know that. Well, they used a trick. The trick is kind of clever. Down at the bottom of the page, there's some links to popular sites. Well, the browser, by default, will highlight sites that you've visited before as visited links. In this case, it's marking them red. So that button just has a little script that says, look at every hyperlink on the page, and if it's red, I know the user's been there before. So it's able to detect. He goes to NewYorkTimes.com, he goes to Live.com. Well, they could do a lot. They could put 1,000 sites in there and see the popular sites I go to. And in fact, they could probably detect that I'm a male between 25 and 35 years old. I live in the Pacific Northwest. I don't like sports. I do like computers. They can detect so much information about me. Well, one of the cool things about the in-private mode is basically in-private doesn't actually keep track of visited links. And so when I go to this where have you been, it's not going to find anything because if you look down at the bottom, nothing's highlighted. Because while you're in private browsing mode, not only do we not maintain any history for you, we also essentially wipe your store of visited links so that you can't detect this feature. Now, if I was me, I'd go do this demo in Chrome and Firefox and show that they don't have this cool thing, but we're kind of running out of time, so we'll skip over that. We already did the demo for that. In private, you can just start an in private session, so basically I can go... So basically, I'm at, let's just start a normal browser instance, right? So I'm here, at my home page, and what I can do is click on the safety menu, and I can do in-private browsing, and now I've got a new in-private session. Alternatively, if I just open a new tab page, I have an in-private browsing window option here, so I can open it. So normal users can do it. You can use Vista Parental Controls to turn that off, and you can also use Group Policy to turn it off if you don't want your users using in-private. All right, some background on third-party aggregation. Oh, sorry, question. So the question is basically, can you enforce in-private browsing on a per-website basis, basically? So I always want this site to open in private.
Right.
The answer is not presently. It is a very common feature request. One of the things you can do is there's actually a... on the Enhance IE page, so I've got a website called www.enhanceie.com. I have a registry script that will put a context menu item on all of the shell shortcuts so that you can choose open in private, and it will always, basically you can just pick open in private on any favorite. Making particular hyperlinks always open in private is a pretty cool feature. We don't have that right now. So some background on third-party aggregation. One of the issues around the sort of shared privacy is the fact that sometimes as the user browses around the web, a profile can pretty surreptitiously be created for them. So in this case, the user has visited this Contoso.com site. This Contoso.com site is actually pulling in content from the site on the bottom right. It's a content syndicator. Maybe it's an ad platform. Maybe it's some kind of metrics platform, hit counter, and things like that. That in and of itself isn't a big deal. What happens is, as the user visits more and more sites, they don't even know about the site in the bottom right-hand corner, but that site in the bottom right-hand corner is able to actually build a pretty comprehensive profile of all the sites that user visits because their content is in all those sites. And so the issue with that, essentially, is you've got this problem where this third-party site that has no trust relationship at all with the user is able to see where they've been, and the user doesn't even know about it. They don't even know what the privacy policy or anything else is. And so what we've introduced in IE8 is what's called in-private filtering. And what in-private filtering does Let me just boot up the product. In private filtering, there's this little icon down here. You can hit Control-Shift-F if you want to turn it on. And what it will do is you can choose different settings. So I can choose content to block manually, or I can choose automatically block. When we go into settings, basically, I have the ability to see, I have the ability to set a threshold. And that threshold is, how many sites do I have to see this particular piece of third-party content on before I decide that it's a privacy issue? And so if a content aggregator can track me across, you know, 3 sites or 5 sites or 10 sites, I get to decide what my threshold is. And then if a site exceeds that threshold, we'll actually block traffic to that site while you're in private filtering mode. And so we're preventing the privacy leak by preventing traffic from going to that third-party site. And so you're able to use this feature to control, you know, basically your browser's communication with people that are potentially tracking you. As a content provider, you have the ability to sort of, you know, plead your case in this UI. Unfortunately, I don't use this machine to browse a lot. I deleted my browsing history recently. But, you know, if you saw an ad provider in here, you can actually click on that ad provider and choose basically more information and then get to see what the policy practices that this third-party content promises to abide by. And so through this mechanism, in private filtering, it allows the user awareness and control, if they want it, of the third-party traffic. Yes. I'm actually going to open it up entirely to questions now, so I don't know how much time or whether I'm even over, but go ahead and...
With IEA, it handled cross-site scripting pretty well, but what about SQL injection, which is the rise on the security?
Yeah, so SQL injection is a huge problem. The interesting thing about SQL injection is that SQL injection is attack against the web server where the browser doesn't even need to participate. So if your site has a SQL injection vulnerability, I can telnet to port 80 and type my attack. I don't even need to misuse the user's browser for that. And so while cross-site scripting is a server-side vulnerability as well, cross-site scripting is not interesting unless I have the ability to get the user's browser to do that attack on my behalf, because otherwise I'm just exploiting myself. SQL injection is different because once I get your site polluted by SQL injection, he's going to attack everybody else that visits him later. And so SQL injection is an attack that basically you need to fix on the server side. If we were to try and detect SQL injection in the browser, all that would happen is a bad guy would go install, you know, Netscape 2 and use that to attack your site, or use, you know, Fiddler or another network traffic device to attack your site, because the attack is against a different principle than the person who's, you know, sending that content to the server. And so Internet Explorer 8 doesn't make any attempt to prevent the user from being exploited by SQL injection directly, because it's an attack against the website. Now, the one thing I will say is the most common thing that people do with SQL injection now is they will inject into a website markup that causes, you know, for instance, an iframe that goes to some third-party site and attempts to do a drive-by vulnerability of the user. Well, within Internet Explorer 8, because of the per-site, we've actually done a significant attack surface reduction there, because even if there's a SQL injection that causes a legitimate site to echo out an attack script against the user, chances are quite good that that attack script isn't going to work, because ActiveX opt-in, per-site ActiveX, DepNX will all help to prevent that exploit from occurring. And so while we don't prevent, you know, the cross-site script or the SQL injection attack, we do prevent the most dominant that the bad guys want to do with a SQL injection attack. But if your site has something where there's a SQL injection where they can steal your entire customer database, the browser isn't even involved at all. And so putting the protection in the browser doesn't really make sense. So how does Internet Explorer, if it does a typo in the address bar and ends up in a spammer's website? And so the answer really is, it depends on what the site is trying. Did I go offline? Okay, so if the site is trying to spoof a legitimate website, so you type liive.com, and it's a site that tries to ask the user, hey, what's your live ID password? You need to log in. This is the legitimate Microsoft site. It's going to get blocked by Smart Screen because it's a spoof. It's attempting to fraudulently obtain information from the user using a misleading domain name. Now, if it's just kind of a spammy website where, you know, I type for, you know, www.google.com with 6 O's instead of 2, And instead of pretending to be Google, it actually clearly looks like something else and just has a lot of like, hey, search with us or something like that, then it wouldn't be blocked. The user does get sort of the browser information. We'll highlight in the address bar what part of the URL is the legitimate URL. And, of course, if there was a problem, the user can report that site as malicious. But we don't attempt to enforce any kind of, like, trademark or anything like that unless it's being used for malice. So the question is, do we annoy the user if they turn off Smart Screen Filter? And the answer is, we don't annoy the user if they turn off Smart Screen Filter, but firstly, it's worth noting that Smart Screen Filter can be group policy controlled, so you can enforce it upon everyone if you want. And also, there's a bunch of different third-party, or well, not third-party, but non-Internet Explorer things that will actually notify the user. So in particular, if you have Windows OneCare installed and Smart Screen is disabled, OneCare will say, hey, you're really not safe in your current configuration. And I believe on Windows 7, the troubleshooter will actually tell you, hey, you don't have Smart Screen enabled. But ultimately, it comes down to user choice. Some users don't want to have the Smart Screen filter enabled, and so we're not going to, you know, penalize them for that.
Question about the in private filtering?
Yes.
Okay. Can I just open that plate? You don't mind? Yeah. So in this case, if there is a website which is tracking the link click of a particular user session, so will that also be blocked by this in-private filtering feature?
So in-private filtering is all about blocking content from third-party websites. And so in particular, if the link click tracking script was injected by a third party, so all of these 8 sites, for instance, had a script source equals link click track.com whack track click.js.
Okay, go ahead.
So in that case, we would block that script from getting downloaded. Now, if on the other hand, all of these sites linked to a particular third party, you know, clicktrack.com, and all of their hyperlinks went to clicktrack.com, that is not considered sort of the surreptitious information gathering that we're trying to block, because the user actually would see the page navigate over to clicktrack.com and so forth and can make their security decision in that way.
Well, that did not answer my question. My question is that if a website has a third party which is tracking the link click of, you know, different URLs within the same website through a JavaScript.
Right, but where does the JavaScript come from is the question.
From the same website. So in this case, the user is opening a website, say foo.com.
Uh-huh.
Foo.com has a JavaScript.
Yeah.
Which runs on the user's browser.
Yeah.
To track the different link clicks of that particular user with a third party.
So foo.com has a script from foo.com that watches the user's interaction on foo.com.
Yes,
and tracks,
reports it to,
and tracks all of their clicks on foo.com.
Right.
And then reports via presumably some back-end service?
Yes.
Yes. So that is something that the client won't see because the browser is not a party to that transaction. Now,
okay.
Sorry.
Will that still work?
It will work, yes, because there's no third party involved as far as the browser is concerned because the third party is only involved on the back-end. And so in particular, you know, it's not a panacea, right? So if you go to a website and that website takes all of your data and ships it off on tape to, you know, evil overlord tracking, right, there's nothing the browser can do about that. The browser's not even a party to that transaction. And so, no, in-private filtering would not help in that case. But what it does force, basically, people who want to do this to do is host all of that stuff on their site. Well, one of the values of that is it then becomes very clear that the privacy policy of that site is relevant for this third-party content. And so basically that site is absorbing responsibility for using that data in accordance with their own privacy policy.
Thank you.
So about DNSSEC? No. So these are all Internet Explorer 8 features. The only thing we've talked about today, which is not part of Internet Explorer 8, was DNSSEC, which is a system for securing DNS, which is part of the platform, and it's not widely deployed and so forth. But everything we've talked about today is an Internet Explorer 8 feature.
Mm-hmm.
sorry. You're saying Internet Explorer 7 is running in the background?
Yeah.
So first off, we'd love to take a look. When I'm talking about this third-party aggregation, all of these features only run when the browser is running. And so if you see Internet Explorer running and it's not open, then something else is going wrong. One of the cases we've seen is certain old versions of, like, the Java virtual machine weren't shutting down properly. And so you end up where you close IE, but the iExplorer.instance hangs around in the background and so forth. The most common thing that we see where Internet Explorer is running but isn't visible is there's some sort of buggy add-on. Both IE7 and IE8 include a no add-ons mode. And so one of the things you can try is launch IE in no add-ons mode and see if the problem exists. If not, then you found a buggy add-on and you can go through and figure out which one it is. But otherwise, you can also just send me an email and I would be happy to point you to troubleshooting tips and so forth. Question in the back?
Yeah, when you're in private mode, right, I understood that the data is stored in DOM storage.
No, so, sorry. When you're in private mode, all potentially persistent data is downgraded to session data. And so DOM storage is a feature much like cookies, and it's got two modes, session mode and permanent mode. When you're in private browsing, all of your DOM storage data goes down to session mode. And so if you go and persist a cookie or persist a DOM store element, while you're in private mode, that entry will be deleted when the browsing session exits, when you exit in private mode.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question in regard to the smart screen filter. Is it built to work along with your security suite?
Absolutely. And so basically the way that smart screen works is it's URL reputation based. What this is we keep track of the reputations of URLs. So if you go to a site that's always delivering malicious software, so Perfect Defender 2009 is a great example. Perfect Defender 2009 is just a malicious site. Everything they give you will be malicious. It doesn't matter whether it's perfectdefender2009.exe or malware.exe or you really need this.exe, everything they give you will be malicious. The value in Smart Screen is we know that perfectdefender2009.com is malicious, and so everything they give you we can block very easily. Now, in contrast, so we've got reputation-based systems, and then we have signature-based systems. Signature-based systems describes most typical antivirus and anti-malware, where basically we've got researchers that sit around in labs all day looking at malicious software, identifying it, generating a signature for it, and pushing it out to the users. So the great thing about signature-based systems is you can block threats no matter where they appear. It doesn't matter what website you're on. If you find that hash, it's malicious. The downside is, there's a lag in terms of the time needed to generate that signature because, you know, when the new version of Perfect Defender Evilness comes out, they've got to generate a new signature. That takes time. Whereas from the URL reputation standpoint, we know that everything coming from that site is malicious. So by having both reputation and signature-based protections working together in concert, we're able to protect against a much larger set of threats. They also work together nicely because using systems like Defender, which reports if the user opts in back to SpyNet to say, hey, this website gave me this piece of malicious software, we're able to block that site from a reputation basis and vice versa. Once we know a given site is always distributing malware, the malware researchers will go there, download everything, and generate signatures for it. And so, yes, these systems work best in concert. So by pairing a signature-based system with a reputation-based system, you're in the best boat.
I know for a fact that it has issues to deal with Norton 360, for example.
Yes. So Norton 360, Norton has not yet released an IE8 compatible version of their product. One thing I will point out, though, is some of the systems, so Norton, for instance, Norton has both reputation and signature-based products together. Now, while you might want additional reputation-based systems, that's really at your discretion. The value is in getting a reputation system plus a signature-based system, mix and match if you want. And so even though, you know, Norton will complain, hey, your anti-spyware filter isn't working, they're still doing signature-based stuff on the client itself. What they're not able to do is their reputation-based thing. And so that's where Smart Screen is actually covering that half of the equation. But we anticipate, and Norton has actually promised to release an IE8-compatible version of their product. I just don't know the estimated time for that.
Yeah, how is IE8, a guest site handled differently than the in private mode aggregation? And also, does it work in private mode?
So Suggested Sites is a feature which is available as a part of Internet Explorer 8, and what it does is if the user opts in during first run, Suggested Sites will keep track of the sites that you visit and suggest to you other sites that might align with your interests. And so if you go to, like, social networking sites and so forth, it might offer a social networking site, or if you go to video sharing sites, it might offer a video sharing site that you haven't been to. Suggested Sites is entirely opt-in. It's entirely up to the user whether or not they want to use it. If the user browses to secure sites, those are not considered as part of the evaluation. And so if you visit a bunch of secure websites, those URLs are not used in determining other sites that you might potentially like. Also, any sites on your intranet are not used because obviously we don't know anything about your intranet. We don't know what sites to suggest. And while you're in private mode in particular, none of the sites you visit in private mode are used as suggestions. So I could go to every My Little Pony site in the world in private mode, and when I'm out of in private mode, even if I have suggested sites turned on, I'm not going to get any suggestions related to My Little Pony. So basically, Suggested Sites respects the in private mode. It's an entirely opt-in feature. The user has to choose to turn it on if they want it. But other than that, there's really no relationship between those two features.
On your reputation system, how do you protect against malicious reputation, meaning like where someone falsely...
How do you protect against cramming attacks where someone says, hey, my competitor is evil? Yes.
Exactly.
So our system is basically very finely tuned because we've been doing this for a while. And what it comes down to is sites are never automatically blocked by anything. Microsoft actually spends quite a lot of money getting sort of vetted data from both third-party databases and our own databases around malicious sites. So if the user reports a site is malicious, that doesn't automatically get blocked. What happens is it goes into a grading queue, and we have graders who will basically go determine whether or not the site is malicious and then block it if it is. Now, there's a bunch of different factors that go into that grading queue, including, you know, where is the site? Does it actually look like a high-profile site? How many people have reported it? Is this IP address space? Actually, I'm probably talking about things that I shouldn't be. Anyway, there's lots of different features that go into this reputation and weighting. Nothing gets automatically blocked. Everything is blocked by a human grader. It's kind of amusing because the false positives we have are usually as a result of the vendors messing up. And so, in fact, one of the major e-commerce sites on the web found their brand new initiative site blocked. They said, you're blocking our brand new site. It's legitimate. Why would you do that? And we tracked it back to the data provider, and the data provider got it from that site as a malicious site. And so someone working at that e-commerce company said, we don't have this new initiative. That's a fake site. And it flowed through the system. But the value of the way that we do blocking is actually we're able to very quickly turn around in the event that there is a false positive. But malicious false positives are actually very difficult to execute because we have humans along every step of the way. I think I'm probably now over, so.
Thanks, Eric. We are just having a break now, and we can have lunch. Lunch is served outside of the room. And we will be back with Steven talking about expression super preview in...